Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, wrapping up a week of news, and there sure was lots of it. From the revelations about Donald Trump in Bob Woodward's new book.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
To reporting in The Atlantic that revealed the president disparaged members of the military, to the Department of Justice announcement that they would intervene in a defamation lawsuit against Donald Trump, to wildfires raging out west. When I need someone to make sense of a mind-boggling week of news, I turn to longtime guest Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute. I spoke to Norm Thursday afternoon. Norm Ornstein, good to have you with us.
It is always a pleasure to speak to you, Diane.
Thank you. Let's talk first about the Bob Woodward book and all the revelations that we've so far seen coming out of that book. My first question to you is, why do you think President Trump thought he could speak so frankly to Bob Woodward?
You know, one of the great mysteries of the last 2.5 decades is every time there is a Woodward book that really sheds a spotlight, often a very negative one, on major figures, the next book gets the same reaction and people talk to him. And I think for many of them, it's talking to him out of the belief that if they don't, it will be worse. And what we know is there was an earlier book by Woodward on the beginnings of the Trump administration. Many people, including Kellyanne Conway, did talk to him. It was a negative book. Trump was furious and basically thinks, and this is part of what a narcissist thinks, that he can convince anybody of how wonderful he is. And thought that he could, in some ways, I think, con Bob Woodward, who would be more sympathetic to him than some of the other journalists. But the extent to which he opened up to Woodward with all of these interviews and allowed them to be taped so that there was no deniability is mind-boggling. It's gobsmacking. And of course, it's deeply, deeply incriminating.
Well, and the most incriminating aspects, it seems to me, for the American public are what he told Bob Woodward about what he knew and when he knew it about the coronavirus.
You know, I had two immediate reactions to this. The first was, so he's not as dumb as many people think, that he didn't realize how bad this was, that he was in his own little world and, you know, created all of this disaster that followed from it, that he actually knew what was going on, which makes it in so many ways so much more damning and incriminating, that you knew that the virus was a deadly one, that you knew and said that it was spread through the air, and that you let people walk around without masks, that you continue even to this day to have the signal sent to people that you don't need to wear a mask, that you tribalize the wearing of masks. And if you look at the results that have followed and that continue to, as compared to the rest of the world, there are more than 7.5 billion people in the rest of the world. The rest of the world ended up with many, many fewer deaths combined than in the 331 million people in the United States. And we know that from the experience of countries like Australia, a conservative government, a leader who was not terribly well respected, who followed the science and ended up with soaring popularity, that one of the great ironies here is that if Trump had done what other leaders did, if he in fact had followed through on what he knew was the case and followed what health experts said, He might be coasting to re-election right now.
So what do you make of the fact that he said, I didn't want to frighten people?
So today we have yet another tweet from President Trump, and there's always a tweet. If you elect Joe Biden, the cities are going to be in complete havoc. Buildings will be burned. People will die. The suburbs will disappear. Remember what he said about the caravan coming up from the south. This is a president who loves to create panic when it serves his interest. So this defense is an absolutely nonsensical defense. What he wanted to do, I believe, was at the time, because we saw the stock market going down, was to make sure that he didn't have a collapse in the stock market, the one calling card that he had in his quest for re-election, and that many, many people died as a consequence was of no great concern to him. But once he started down that path, Donald Trump was incapable of changing course. And I have to say, Diane, we're in a tribal environment and this is a cult. And to see today that Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, all in on this cult, said that all of those people who gathered in Sturgis, the hundreds of thousands mingling together for days, going into bars, no masks, and then traveling around the country and spreading the virus, that they were just exercising their freedom, tells us that once they start down a dangerous and destructive path, they will all just double down and triple down. And the result is going to be not just many, many more Americans dying, but you probably know people as I do who got the virus and have ended up not dying, but with organ failures or terrible, terrible continuing debilitating effects. And that they continue to do this instead of changing course is macabre and so damning that it is hard to even express it in words.
So you believe that had he spoken honestly back in January, when he was first told that this was a very dangerous virus, it could be really the most dangerous thing that could happen during his presidency, had he said that to the American people and said, you must protect yourself, you must stay at home, if you must go out, you must wear a mask, do you think that even those who trust him implicitly would have avoided the kinds of gatherings you've just spoken of?
When Donald Trump downplayed the use of masks and said this wasn't important, he set out an army of enablers on Fox News, on talk radio, on social media, to basically say, if you wear a mask, you're giving aid and comfort to the liberals. Now, we know from the experience of other countries, and it's a country like Australia that took those actions and ended up with almost no deaths. And of course, they've seen outbreaks of minor proportions occur in cities since that it can happen. But we also know in a country where they had immediate devastation, Italy, where they then responded with the appropriate remedies, that they've kept it under control. So there's just absolutely no question that if you look at and extrapolate from other countries' experiences, if Donald Trump had acted the way that other leaders did around the world, we would have maybe 15 or 20,000 deaths instead of 194,000 at this point. We would have an economy in much better shape. We wouldn't have evictions. We wouldn't have businesses going under. We wouldn't have the problems that we now have with schools and with children. And we would be in a much better place. That's a brutal reality. And there is empirical evidence to support it.
Norm, let me ask you about another aspect of the book. his comments on North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
So we know a couple of things about Donald Trump. One is, flatter him and you will be rewarded with praise. Criticize him in any fashion and he will come back at you viciously. Kim Jong-un was smart enough to refer to him as Excellency, to praise him, and just as important, to diss Barack Obama. All of that was music to Trump's ears. The second thing we know about Trump, and it refers not just to Kim Jong-un, but to Vladimir Putin, to Duterte, to Orban, to Sisi, to Erdogan, is his role models are jackboot dictators. His role models are people who have taken control of their countries, intend to govern for life, allow their families to be enriched at the expense of the rest of the country, crack down on dissidents, shut down the free press. These are the leaders that he praises on a regular basis. And of course, he goes after leaders who don't follow that pattern. Democrats with a small D, like Angela Merkel, Macron, and Trudeau, among others. So the praise for Kim Jong-un and what he gave Kim Jong-un to get nothing in return, the reflection of a reality that it endangered America's national interest, holding summits with Kim Jong-un, which other presidents would not do, basically gave legitimacy to one of the most brutal and vicious murderers and murderous regimes in the world, and enabled them to further their nuclear ambitions, despite his promises that this would all come to a halt. It's a reflection of a kind of deal-making, but also of the narcissistic personality that if you have something like that operating, our country suffers. It isn't just that he is hurting the people of North Korea by giving legitimacy to this dictator. It's that he is not advancing the national interests of the United States.
I thought it was fascinating to learn that the president bragged about having created a nuclear weapon system that no one else has seen or had before. Do we know there is truth to that?
We do know that we've been working on very advanced technological works in the arms area. But what's striking about that is to give that kind of information, which otherwise we would view as highly classified, to a journalist because you're bragging, also fits a pattern of carelessness by Trump. Go back to Mar-a-Lago, where they do not have secured internet, where he uses his unsecured cell phone, where he's met in the dining room and talked about highly classified matters with his team, while we also know agents from China, Russia, and elsewhere, at what for them is a very cheap price, the $200,000 initiation fee, can go in there and hear the president in a fashion that is otherwise much harder for them to get. Again, it shows a reckless disregard for the security of the United States to advance the ego of the president. There are so many things here that we have never, ever seen before from a leader of this country that just boggle the mind.
And now I want to turn to the Department of Justice defending Donald Trump. Why would the Department of Justice and William Barr, the Attorney General, take on a private matter? What is the justification for that?
We know from many, many prior experiences that William Barr does not view himself as the Attorney General of the United States. He is the consigliere for Donald Trump, the President of the United States. He is using the power of the Justice Department to advance the political interests and personal interests of the president. What this involves, of course, is a defamation lawsuit by E. Jean Carroll, who had accused President Trump from times before he was president of raping her in a dressing room in a department store. Trump, while he was president, basically slimed E. Jean Carroll, and she filed a defamation suit, a private civil lawsuit. It has been moving forward towards discovery, and Barr stepping in is not only an outrageous and egregious abuse of governmental power, a violation of his oath of office, but it is also an attempt to try to protect the president in his private capacity by throwing a wrench into this lawsuit that at minimum will extend the time, very likely past the election, when damning material about Donald Trump's sexual assaults might emerge. It is simply outrageous, and one of many things that Barr has done as Attorney General that make every previous Attorney General, including from the Nixon era, look like models of deportment in comparison.
Could the lawsuit simply go away because Trump is considered under sovereign immunity?
If we get a judge who agrees with Barr, and in this case, it can only be a judge who is in the pocket of Donald Trump, and this becomes not a matter of Donald Trump, but of the president, then the lawsuit could end up being dismissed for just that reason, that as a president, and of course the theory here is that he was acting in his official capacity as a president when he slimed a private citizen because of the assault charges against him. If that happened, that at least is conceivable. I think it's more likely that we will see a judge, if there's any honesty in the judge, dismissing this, but then having the Justice Department appeal and continue appeals in an attempt to delay this. And it's not entirely clear that other levels of courts would consider it on an expedited basis.
Norm, this sounds to me like the threat of an autocracy, that a high-level official, the Department of Justice Attorney General, would put aside what I believe would be all honor and take on this case as though it were between him, Barr, a private lawyer, and the President of the United States.
I do not see William Barr as having any integrity. This is a lawless attorney general, which is the worst thing you could say about an attorney general. But, you know, we have scandal after scandal, corrupt act after corrupt act throughout the administration. And if you do not have a Justice Department or U.S. attorneys who are willing to take these things on, you know, consider that we have a Postmaster General who shouldn't be there in the first place, who was only put there after he was imposed upon the system by the chairman of the Postal Board of Governors, who is a leader in the Trump campaign, who now we know from multiple testimony engaged in utterly corrupt behavior by giving millions in campaign contributions coming from his employees, which he then reimbursed with tax-deductible bonuses, which means he's violated tax law as well as campaign finance law. And we learned from the Washington Post today that the Postal Board of Governors met with him and said they're just thrilled with everything that he's done. If this is the kind of behavior we have, it's not just the threat of an autocracy, we're living in the midst of an autocracy. And of course, they're thrilled with the Postmaster General for one reason, because he's trying to steal the election, put his thumb on the scales of voting by mail, and of course, along the way, is damaging seniors who can't get their pharmaceuticals sent by mail on time, and people who are not getting checks or who are seeing that their rent checks are not getting in and are under the threat of eviction. The level of mendacity here, of poor, horrible governance of kleptocracy, people benefiting personally from government, and of autocratic actions just to benefit the president and his family, is something that you would expect in Russia, that you might expect in today's Turkey, that we see in Saudi Arabia and North Korea, but we've never expected to see it in the United States.
And that's where I want to go next. That is the whistleblower allegations on manipulating data regarding Russia. And the young man, Brian Murphy, the whistleblower, has brought these allegations, saying that he was told directly to downplay any information regarding what Russia might be doing in the 2020 election because he feared that would reflect back on what Russia did in the 2016 election. And so Brian Murphy was moved out of that position into an administrative job. Where are we with this kind of whistleblower information that it takes journalists to draw out because we do not have a person who is the acting Homeland Security Secretary, Chad Wolf, who is protecting the homeland?
An illegal acting Secretary of Homeland Security, another outrageous abuse of power. He was only recently nominated for the position of Homeland Security Secretary. For many months, he violated the Vacancies Act. All the actions that he's taken, which include, of course, vicious actions with paramilitary forces in Portland and in the District of Columbia, and more child separation and actions at the border, are themselves illegal. What we now know from the whistleblower, who was a top-level intelligence officer, is that the order to do this came to Chad Wolf, apparently, from the National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien. They are directly being traitors to the security of the United States. I'm not exaggerating on that front. They are trying to keep vital information about our largest and most significant and dangerous adversary, Russia, which is, even as we speak, interfering in the election. We now know Microsoft warned Joe Biden of Russian attempts to get into their areas of communication. We know that the Russians put malware into registration data for voting in 2016 in counties in Florida. We know that the director of national intelligence, who lied about his qualifications, who should not be in that job, but was only put there because 51 Republican senators closed their eyes to his misconduct, has said there's no truth to the Russians being involved. It's all about the Chinese. They are distorting America's intelligence to benefit the political interests of the President of the United States while damaging America's intelligence apparatus and our national security. It doesn't fit the formal narrow definition of treason, which has to be considered only when you are at war with an adversary, but by any reasonable definition, they are committing treason to the United States.
And what about the sharing of data with the Congress that had previously been done on an oral basis and now is only to be done on a written basis without the ability of members of Congress to ask their own questions?
Here again, we have a director of national intelligence who's violating every norm of behavior and the law, which requires that this information be given to the leaders of the intelligence committees in the House and Senate and to the party leaders. The rationale for this is leaks. What kinds of leaks did he say? Ones that suggested that Russia was more dangerous than China. And of course, we have no evidence that the Chinese are intervening with malware, with attempts to secure emails as they did in 2016 in the way that Russia is. It's only a narrative proposed by the president and his minions to try to protect his own interests and to allow Russia to intervene to try to put the thumb on the scales of the election. We keep using terms like mind-boggling, but that's just what it is. And one of the challenges we're going to have, Diane, if with all of these headwinds, Joe Biden wins, is what we do about all of the miscreants involved here. You know, there are going to be people saying, all right, let's put it behind us. And it's only in bad societies that you punish the losers in an election. But we're in an unprecedented place. And I believe we need to set up a mechanism as fair as could be that will mete out justice to people who have brazenly and blatantly corrupted the system, acted for their own interests, and that includes many people in the cabinet and in the White House and others. They will have to be held to account, or else what they'll be told is, hey, the next time we're in power, we can just do it again.
Including the president?
I believe that it should include the president. Now, I will tell you one scenario that may happen here. And remember, we're not just talking about the dangers leading up to the election and the election itself or the days and weeks that follow before we get a firm result. But let's say that we know that Biden has won. We have this long transition period from November right up till January 20th. We know that Donald Trump and the people around him will try and leave a scorched earth for the successor, not give him anything that will enable him to govern well. We know that there will be many tempted to destroy evidence that's incriminating for them. And it may well be along the way that Donald Trump will go to Joe Biden and say, I'll tell you what, I'll stop doing these things and I'll get people to stop doing them. But you have to not just make sure that I am not prosecuted, but get the Attorney General of New York and the District Attorney of New York to go along. We may be in a position where, in effect, they're blackmailed to keep him from getting to the bar of justice.
Do you really believe that could happen?
Yeah, I do. I think one of the things that's motivating Trump in this election campaign is the fear that all of the things that have been done that are illegal, including things that were done before he became president, tax law violations and other miscreants, and very possibly, of course, a lot of the damning information about his connections to Putin and to the crown prince in Saudi Arabia, connections that involve corruption of his family in advancing their own interests and finances during this presidency, that all of that will come out. And he, if he stays in power, he can keep it from happening. You know, what actions will he take? Are there any boundaries? It's hard for me to see any boundaries.
More of my conversation with Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and contributing editor for The Atlantic, when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
I want to ask you about another publication that came out, the Atlantic article by Jeffrey Goldberg, using quotes that he had received attributed directly to Donald Trump about his attitudes, his thoughts, his beliefs about the military. Talk about those quotes.
Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, got a number of people off the record. We don't know exactly who. Former military officers, people who worked in the Trump administration and others, to suggest that Trump had regularly voiced often obscene comments of disdain about those in the military, the sense that people who went in were losers, because why would you do this if you're not going to get anything financially out of it, that people who died or were prisoners of war were losers and suckers. And of course, we get a vigorous pushback and denial, but we know a few things, Diane. One is This all is reinforced by the memoir written by his niece, Mary Trump, by a number of other people who've heard him speak, by his comments on the record about John McCain, about other prisoners of war, by his comments about generals, which he made publicly in a couple of instances. And we now know from what we see in the Woodward book, another set of obscene comments about generals. We know what he just said the other day, which in a way implicitly suggested that these quotes that Goldberg got, which also have been reiterated by a number of other journalists in the Washington Post and on Fox News, to pick some examples, that he knows that generals have made these comments. We have a conspicuous silence from people like John Kelly about one of those incidents reported by Goldberg when they went to the cemetery and viewed the gravesite of Kelly's son who died in combat, and Trump saying that he couldn't understand why anybody would do this. Kelly hasn't denied it, and others have reported that Kelly told them this as well. It fits a pattern as well. Donald Trump is a transactional person. He views everybody else in the world as either being smart because they act in a fashion that benefits their own interests, financial and otherwise, and you're dumb if you do something for other reasons, including to protect your own country. There is little here that can be downplayed given what everybody else has said and what Trump has said himself.
So how much support from the military did Donald Trump get in the last election? And do you think that support will be knocked down because of these revelations?
So we know from the survey done in the Military Times that the president really hated of military personnel that showed him losing to Joe Biden, which is a very unusual phenomenon. And we have to mention one other outrageous element of this, which is the Russian bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. The president refusing to condemn Putin or to suggest that this could have happened, even as he has refused to blame Russia for the poisoning of Alexander Navalny. All of that, I think, has affected his support among the troops. They're traditionally more Republican than Democratic. But remember, we're not just talking about people in the military. We're also talking about military families. And you have to believe that as all of these things have emerged, that it's going to give a lot of people pause. Those who otherwise have liked what he had to say. We had a very interesting column in the Washington Post as well about how initially generals really liked Trump because he was decisive. And we had David Ignatius wrote that as he talked to generals, that when they were talking about taking action against some of the ISIS leaders, that they told David, Obama would have had meeting after meeting after meeting before doing this. And Trump just said, go ahead. But they grew increasingly alarmed at his shallowness, at his willingness to send troops into combat for his own purposes, including the one raid in Yemen that resulted in the death that he did just because Obama wouldn't do it, that they've seen the reactions that he's had, and that while many of them have felt constrained about commenting, we know that General Mattis did for a very, very long period of time, for example, because they don't think it's appropriate for military leaders, even retired ones, to be engaged in political activities. We know that the top military brass, the best of the best, are deeply, deeply alarmed at the commander-in-chief.
And now, Norm, let's talk about racism and the extent to which apparently Mr. Trump takes no responsibility for anything.
So we know that Donald Trump will never take responsibility for anything negative, will always try and claim credit for anything positive, will also lie about things to claim credit. He has said now hundreds of times that he did the Veterans Act that was done in the Obama administration. And even when he's been told that's inaccurate, he keeps saying it, believing that if you say it over and over, people will believe it. We know that there will be no consequences for him, that he will not take responsibility or act in a fashion that we would expect from the President of the United States to to heal wounds and bring people together, that instead he's trying to exploit all of this for his own benefit. We know that we're seeing more and more instances of police misconduct, of overreach. In the case of Rochester, it's something that I find troubling on a couple of fronts. I have been engaged, as you know, in working on criminal justice reform and the way in which people with mental illness are treated. And in many instances, police are trained to escalate. And if you're dealing with somebody with autism, we had a young man shot 7 times when his mother called the police because they needed help. And if you escalate with somebody with autism or with serious mental illness, you're going to get a bad reaction. And their first response is to shoot or to put a hood over somebody's head who's clearly in a psychotic episode and then put them on the ground and asphyxiate them. Those things are a combination of bad training. And if you have a serious mental illness and you are Black or a person of color, you have a much, much greater likelihood of having it end in tragedy. And the response in many police departments is to double down, and just as with Trump, to deny responsibility. The public reaction is going to escalate every time we see one of these. We're now seeing commendable responses from many quarters, including the NBA, which has been a national leader on this. Even the NFL, which has been the opposite, is starting to come around a little bit. There is an understanding among many people, many white people, especially those with college educations, that this is racism and we've got a serious problem that has not been resolved in this country. We need to deal with it. We need a president who responds to that in a positive fashion instead of escalating the conflict, but we have the latter.
And yet when asked whether he thought there was systemic racism in this country by Bob Woodward, Trump responded, "Boy, you've really bought the Kool-Aid, haven't you?"
Of course, we know that Donald Trump, going back to his early career with his father, demonstrated a pattern of racist behavior, had to have a settlement with the Justice Department over discrimination. We know from a story in the New York Times today, something that I knew about before, that when he met with African-American leaders, it was all for show and nothing came of it. This was particularly a meeting that was arranged by a group that I co-founded, Why Tuesday, with Martin Luther King III and my co-founder, Bill Wachtel, to try and get him to deal with voter IDs that discriminate against people of color. And of course, he did nothing except get the photo op. We also know that Bill Barr, in an interview just this past week, echoed what Trump said, not in the same way with Kool-Aid, but saying, well, there may be some racism, but it's not systemic. And of course, we know that they are escalating the riots that are taking place and creating violence in places like Portland.
How are they doing it?
So we know that we have white supremacists and other militia groups that, for example, went through the streets in Portland spraying toxic materials on protesters. It resulted in a tragic death of one of the white supremacists and then the death of the person who allegedly shot him. But the president only had praise for people going out there armed with assault weapons and using pepper spray and other toxic materials on people who are doing nothing except exercising their constitutional rights. We know what he has done with the paramilitary forces in Washington, D.C. We know that when he went to Kenosha, he did not say anything about the tragedy there involving an African-American young man visit him in the hospital or the family, but basically only went with police who have gotten their backs up about the way in which things transpired. In all of those ways, including going back to the very fine people comment, the president has stood with militia groups, white supremacists, people going out on the streets to do bad things, has criticized Antifa, a loose collection of people, which does include some people acting with violence, but has not, as Joe Biden has done, condemned all the violence, but only the violence he doesn't like.
I want to ask you about these vaccine trials. And whether you believe there is a push on the part of the White House to get a vaccine into operation before the election.
We know what Donald Trump has directly and explicitly said multiple times. We expect we're going to have a vaccine by November 1st, and maybe even earlier in October. Almost all experts in the infectious disease area, including multiple drug companies working on vaccines, say that will simply not happen. We know that even if there is a vaccine that shows up in a very promising fashion, as some have in stage 2 trials, or at the beginning of stage 3 trials, we know that in many cases, those positive results end up turning in a very bad direction later on. There can be side effects. We know from vaccines that you can have anaphylactic shock, for example, in a subset of people. We know that there can be other side effects that flow from vaccines. That's why it typically takes 7 years to roll out a vaccine for something. And while we've spent huge sums of money given to drug companies and to others to come up with vaccines in this case, and we may see another scandal down the road where public money in the form of multiple billions has gone to a company that then from taxpayers that then turn around and charge an arm and a leg for the vaccine. But that will be another story. But we also know that while we can expedite things, move it from 7 years to a year and a half or two, that means if we are in any way fortunate, we will get a tentative rollout of a vaccine maybe early in the new year, next year. And even that will be something done with caution until we're very sure that it has positive effects without the negative ones.
Finally, these fires in the West, Norm, we're talking in reality about global warming, something the president refuses to believe in.
So we know that climate change is causing extreme weather events. I have a son in Los Angeles, and where he was, they had the temperature up to 116. You know, then it's followed by other extreme weather conditions. The fires are likely to get worse with the Santa Ana winds. They've gotten worse every year. We also know that what used to be Category 1 hurricanes are now Category 3 because of the warming of the seas. We're going to have more of this taking place. And if we don't take action soon, it's going to get much, much worse. There's one other element of this that struck me too, Diane, and that is that with the nature of our electoral college and with so many states that are firmly red or firmly blue, if you have a president who doesn't first see himself as dealing with the welfare of the entire country, what happens is that you get extra attention paid to states that you win or that you are competitive in, and disdain for those that don't. Look at the reaction of Trump to the disastrous fires of a couple of years ago in California, basically saying it's their fault. Then you look at how he reacted to hurricanes in Mississippi and Alabama, and again, how he reacted in Puerto Rico. And it's a reason why we have to rethink the Electoral College as well. If everything is competitive, that's one thing. But if you know that you have people in a state who are not going to vote for you, and you're not a great president, your temptation is going to be to favor the places that benefit you and disfavor those that don't. And that's no way to run a country.
Is any of what we've talked about, any of it likely to change the minds of Trump supporters?
When Donald Trump said famously, "I could shoot somebody in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose a vote," there's a lot of truth to that. Somewhere around 40% of Americans, plus or minus 3 or 4%, are with him no matter what. And the basic reason is that to go against him means they will give aid and comfort to those they see as their enemy. We're in a tribal world right now, and it's become more of a cult than a political party. But the real question is, what happens at the margins? What happens with older voters who know that they're more vulnerable to the pandemic and that they have not been served well by the president? what happens to those suburban voters who went for Democrats in 2018 after voting for Trump in 2016, who have been turned off by his crudeness and his mendacity and some of the failures of governance. Where will they be in 2020? And will the attempt to use the law and order card work with them and scare them about the future? What about some of those working class white voters who have been with Trump, but who have not seen their standing in the society improve? And how much of it is driven by the race issue? Those are things we can't resolve at the moment. I have to say that if we get the change in governance, if we have Democrats winning the Senate, winning the House, and having the White House, this is not going to be an easy time. It doesn't mean that people can rest on their laurels. We are going to have so much difficulty getting out of the mess that we're in, so much that will then turn to a kind of opposition party that will do just what it did when Barack Obama was president, unite in opposition and try to discredit and delegitimize. Judges who are chosen for their partisan ideological leanings, who may act to undermine what's being done. The challenges are going to be very, very great. This country is going to go through extremely difficult times, no matter what. I believe our future as a democracy is pretty much gone if we get a Trump re-election and a Republican Senate. And I'm not using hyperbole here, but anybody who thinks that it's going to be easy with what follows is wrong as well. We've got a lot of work to do as a society to recreate and to create anew a country that we can all feel comfortable in and proud of, but there's a necessary first step, and it's going to take place with this election.
Norm, thank you, as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Norm Orenstein, resident scholar at American Enterprise Institute and contributing editor for The Atlantic. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all, and please stay safe by wearing those masks. Take care of yourself and those you love. I'm Diane Reed.